Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. Our last few shows have been focused on local wildlife and different ways to attract it and maintain it in order to help nature. However, on this episode, we discuss with author of 365 Days Wild and campaigner Lucy McRobert how nature can help us and the importance of its role regarding mental health. When talking about how her love for wildlife began, Lucy explained how her passion for nature and wildlife was toned down in her teens due to social pressures of fitting in, something that she also explained still very much exists today in some areas. However, this bulb was switched back on when getting into twitching, something I had never heard of before, but now I've made Lucy promise to take me once lockdown is over. It's been scientifically proven that nature and access to green space improve someone's mental health. Lucy explained how it's more than just going for a walk. Using the senses from touch, smell, sound, and even taste can make the experience so much greater and connect you more to the area you're in. We both agreed that wildlife and nature is essentially a kind of therapy. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Lucy, hello. Thank you so much for joining me on Into the Wild. How are you doing? Are you all well?
Hello. Yes, I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I've done quite a lot of walking today and I'm surprised I've got the energy I have, if I'm honest. But I'm holding on to that and enjoying it.
We've just been playing in a paddling pool, so we are all good to go.
What, two very different days we've had so far.
Yes, very.
Thanks so much for joining me on the show. I'm really excited to talk to you. For the benefit of my listeners around the world, can you just tell us who you are and what is it you do?
Of course. So my name is Lucy McRobert. I am 29 years old and I am a wildlife storyteller, which is a kind of self-assigned awful job title that sounds a lot sexier than it is. Essentially, I'm a nature writer. I published a book last year called 365 Days Wild, which has 365 random acts of wildness that you can do around your home to connect you with nature. I have worked with wildlife charities in campaigns and communications for about 6 years, and I recently went freelance after I'd had my little girl nearly 2 years ago now, and that's been really exciting. So I now work for lots of different organisations doing marketing, communications, storytelling, and generally trying to connect people with nature.
Amazing. So when we look at nature and wildlife, something that you have been focused on and that angle, when and how did your thirst for nature and wildlife begin for you?
Oh, okay. So I have quite a typical story that when I was a kid, I was very into wildlife. My dad's told me stories where I collected literally hundreds of woodlice and snails, and I tried to keep the plant pots in his garage, and they got out and were all over his very expensive racing bike and things like that. So I had that kind of typical wild childhood when I was little, but it wasn't structured. It wasn't because my parents were really into nature. I think they were just a bit lazy, frankly, kind of kicked me outside. Go play, have fun. So that was really lovely. But then when I was a teenager, like so many people, completely lost interest. Not cool, can't possibly be seen doing any of that and going outdoors, that's not trendy at all. And then when I was at university, I actually studied history, which is really unusual for a conservationist. Everyone assumes I'm a scientist. I'm actually an awful scientist. I'm really bad at it. And so I did history, got quite bored with history, and then halfway through did a module in environmental history, which is essentially the history of our environment. And it was really interesting. I got really into it. And from there, began to learn about the conservation movement in the UK, began to learn about things like rewilding and all these exciting projects that were going on. And I thought, I want to be part of that. I remember we had a really great discussion in class about bringing back wolves. And someone said to me, well, what do you think about this? And I said, I want to be one of the people that does that. I think that sounds amazing. And it's just gone from there, really.
Yeah.
So early 20s, took up birding, got really into twitching, which is a whole different story.
Twitching? What's twitching?
Twitching is where you go and look at rare birds in the country.
I've never heard of that term.
It's awful. It's sinful. It's sinful, but it's really fun. If you ever collected Pokemon cards or things like that, you get what twitching is. You essentially drive around the country trying to see rare birds with people. It's really fun. The terrible carbon footprint. I mean, obviously, we've not been doing it because of lockdown.
Yeah.
And I've seen over 400 species of birds now in the UK. So wow. I barely do it anymore because there's not that much around for me to actually go and see.
Have you completed really twitching?
Have I completed twitching?
Have you nearly completed it?
Yeah, leveled up. People actually do. They get so far with birds and think, I'll start on moths now, because I can't see any new birds, so I'll take up mothing instead.
Moth, is that the correct, please tell me that's the term.
I think so. I don't do it personally, but I've heard people talk about mothing.
You nearly said, I have people that do it for me.
Yes, they send them out and they identify them. I don't want to actually do it.
I've never heard of twitching before. I thought it was like a live streaming thing when you first said it, because of Twitch. And then moffin. This is like real life Pokemon Go, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's exactly like real life Pokemon Go. Basically, people around the country go out looking at birds. They find something rare. They phone one of the national channels, who then put it out on an app or a pager or a text service. You get it onto your phone, and then 2,000 people go and see it.
That's amazing.
It's quite fun. It's very geeky, but it's really fun and it's really satisfying. It can be so stressful because then you don't see it, and it's awful. My worst is that I drove to Aberdeen. That's the worst thing I ever did, was I drove to Aberdeen.
To Aberdeen?
To Aberdeen.
To go and see a bird?
To go and see a duck. It's great. This is what we do. There's people way worse than me, though, so it's fine.
And that's, I mean, and you're, I mean, you don't even live in Scotland, so that's not...
No, it was a long day in the snow.
Do you, please tell me you don't battle them.
Oh no, there's nothing like that. You don't actually get to collect them. Lots of people do photograph them, but I'm a terrible photographer, so I don't do that, and photography is very expensive. So I might take a photo on my phone, but that's about it. No, it's about enjoying the bird and enjoying the setting, and there's a nice social scene with it as well.
Amazing. I'm so sorry I stopped you on that point, because I had no idea what that was, and I thought, I need to know that. I've never heard that before. I need to know what that means.
It's fine. It's really good. I mean, the concept of twitching is essentially going to see something that you haven't seen before. So you can arguably twitch something at your local park. You can twitch anything. You can twitch animals. You can twitch trains. People do. It's a kind of train spotting thing. It's kind of plane spotting thing. It's anything in that area, really. But it's very satisfying, and it's a bit competitive, and it's really fun, and it's lovely to see lots of new birds.
In different areas, I guess.
Absolutely. Your sense of geography is outstanding now.
Yeah. Well, especially yours.
It's incredible. Like, I know about places I never would have heard of before. I know where sewage farms are in Somerset that I never would have been to before.
Amazing.
I can't tell you where cities are.
I can't tell you where the nearest pub is, but if you want to know the best place to see a duck, I can send you that.
Absolutely.
You said that it was interesting, something you said then at the beginning, when you said in your early teens and that period you kind of faded away from nature and wildlife because it wasn't as cool and hip. That's quite rare. When I've spoken to people on the podcast, that sometimes doesn't happen with people. It kind of stays with them. Is that just social areas, you think, just pushing you away from that naturally a little bit?
I think so, yeah. I think the school I went to, I went to a comprehensive school that had quite a lot of pressure on how you looked, how you behaved. Mm. We had, it was one of those very typical in-betweeners schools, to be honest, where you had very defined social groups based on what you wore or how clever you were or what kind of makeup you wanted to wear, where you hung out after school. And that is a very restrictive way of growing up. It was an amazing school in some respects, but looking back, that social structure wasn't particularly flexible. And I can't think of anyone that I grew up with that grew up with a really genuine passion or hobby for anything.
Wow.
So that we didn't have like loads of sports players in our group. We didn't have people who were really into anything in particular. And we had to do a thing once on who our hero was, and we all said Orlando Bloom. It was really sad. But that, we didn't really have that kind of connection. Even though we lived in beautiful countryside, we had loads of access to nature, I just think maybe we took it for granted, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think sometimes a lot of, like you said, the passion, no matter where it is there in everyone. It's so evident that just everyone has passion for something. But it does show you that socially, if it's not nurtured out of you, then it can actually just be retained for a long period of time as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I came back to it, and everything that I loved in childhood, I still love now.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely to have those experiences with my little girl now. I remember doing these things with my mum and dad, and getting to do them with her is just so exciting, and it's so rewarding. And I've remembered things from childhood that I wouldn't have remembered otherwise.
Yeah.
So I think it was always there. It just wasn't really at the forefront of what I was doing.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot of incidences where there's things like bullying and kids being told you shouldn't be into that, that's not cool, that's not acceptable. And I think that's a really sad state of affairs, actually, for society,
that we discourage
people from being passionate about things. That's just stupid. We should all be passionate about something, because it's really fun. It's nothing else. It's great fun, and it's interesting.
A lack
of passion makes you the most boring person in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Who wants to be that?
I totally agree with that. If you lack of passion, just, I mean, because like I said, everyone has it for something. I don't think it doesn't exist in people, and it shouldn't really, no matter what it is, you know, within reason, shouldn't be shamed away. It should be, you've got a passion for something, an interest, it makes you an interesting person to hear about that.
Absolutely. It's what's really exciting now, actually, is I think there's a really big wave of young people coming through now who are not letting go of that passion. And I think it's fueled by social media, actually. They get to meet other people who share their passions.
Mm.
So they're not reliant on their immediate social circle in the way that I was when I grew up at school. I was completely reliant on my friends for social interaction.
Yeah.
I think what's really lovely now is I can see loads of young kids all the way through to teenagers who are passionate about birds, mammals, moths, butterflies, and they don't need someone at school to reinforce that. They can have that, and they can have that friendship with someone who genuinely cares about it as well. So I think that's one of the really positives of social media.
Yeah.
Fuel really good community of young people, and they're all campaigning for things now as well. They all care about issues, and that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point. It's not just having that interest now. People are realizing that they have control over certain movements, or can have that voice as well, and that voice matters. I think that's one of the biggest things, like you said, that's happening with the youth in social media. And I'm glad you touched on campaigning there, actually, because you've done a lot of campaign work for wildlife charities over the years. What kind of stuff does that entail when we say campaign work for wildlife charities?
Basically, two different kinds of campaigning. There's political campaigning, advocacy, which is issues like HS2, marine conservation, campaigning to protect a local area, and that's very political. You end up with a lot of correspondence with your MP, or you're targeting a specific minister, a secretary of state, that kind of thing. The other side of campaigning is about engaging people and inspiring people and taking people on a much longer journey. And that was very much my specialism. So I worked for the Wildlife Trusts for 5 years, and the big campaigns that I helped to run there was a campaign called My Wildlife, which told people stories about their connections with nature, which was really lovely. We took these beautiful photos of people in their favourite wild places and really got to the heart of what it was that they loved about that place.
Yeah.
And this evolved into this amazing campaign about mental health and raising awareness of how important green spaces are for our mental health. Off the back of that, we then developed a campaign called 30 Days Wild, which launches this year on the 1st of June. Very exciting.
Yeah.
And that campaign essentially asks you to do something wild every day for 30 days. Really simple, really low entry level stuff. It's not about give your entire garden over to wildlife for 30 days and hope for the best. It's really little things that you can do. And that campaign has just snowballed into what I would say is probably one of the most influential environmental campaigns now happening in the UK.
Yeah.
And it's so exciting because it's all underpinned with data that shows that spending time in green spaces every day, even if it's just for a few minutes, will make you happier and healthier. And that is the kind of campaigning that I am so into. That journey that people go on to embed them in nature is just so exciting.
What do you think it is about the natural world, when we say nature, wildlife, no matter what it is, or the environment around people, what do you think it is that improves our mental state of being? What do you think it is that kind of helps us?
So there's a number of things that play into this. One of the big ones that people forget about is the concept of beauty. So finding beauty in the everyday. A lot of people have this connection with nature based on things that they find to be physically attractive. So that can be rolling countryside, it can be mountains, it can be lakes. But then you can take that much smaller as well to admiring things like flowers, birds, swans on a lake, even if it's a completely kind of man-made area. Even if you're right in the centre of London, you can still find beauty in the concrete landscape. So that is a huge factor playing into this, in that perception of what makes people happy. There's a connection with animals that I think is far more innate, and that's about helping things. I think people, especially people in the UK, are really wired to want to help animals and help wildlife. I think that's why we've got so many like hedgehog hospitals and animal sanctuaries. It's because people really care, and that's why so many people feed the birds. It's an enormous industry. Millions of people around the UK feed the birds. And it's partly because they want to actually help the birds, and it's partly because they want to enjoy them out of their window. So there's this whole thing about connecting with nature through looking at it. There's a whole sensory experience where you smell things, you listen to things. There's a great example of how bird song can influence mental health and physical health. A lot of children's hospitals are now actually using bird song in the corridors to calm children down before they go in for procedures. So there's all these really magical experiences that are to do with sensory experience of nature, touching it, feeling it, even tasting it. Not the stuff that'll kill you, not the poison stuff. But the blackberries are fine. You can eat the blackberries. That kind of multi-sensory experience of nature that really embeds people. And then that extends into the way people talk about it, people writing about it, people drawing it and sketching it. And I always think nature isn't kind of one genre, it's not one thing. It stretches across our entire lives, and no matter who you are, you can find something to do with nature that you will love. Even if you don't think it's for you, there'll be something there that connects you with the wild world, and you will be happier and healthier as a consequence of it.
Yeah. Do you think it's the first step in improving one's mental health to take?
I would say it's, especially now, in the time of lockdown, where so many people's mental health has been put on the line. Essentially, we have taken a hit of our mental health for the benefit of our physical health. Absolutely. Of course we had to. But what we might see at the end of this is actually an absolutely awful situation where lots of people are suffering from isolation, loneliness, problems with reintegrating into society, anxiety and depression based around the fact that we're scared of coronavirus and what it could mean, anxiety because of loss of jobs. And what's been really lovely actually on the other side of that is the amount of people who in this great time of stress have turned to nature as the first thing that they do to actually calm them down and to give them some sense of perspective. And I always kind of knew it. I think most people innately know that wildlife is good for us, that we should be out in nature, that we should let our kids run around outside. We can see it. If you put a kid outside, they're happy. They're, they're running around. It doesn't matter if they pick a few blades of grass or a dandelion. It's fine. There's no rules. There's no regulations. There's no, you crossed a line. You let them explore things, and you see their eyes light up and you see them learn. So we all kind of know it. And I think it's been a conscious decision with so many adults, especially people who are isolated and lonely right now, to go into their garden, to find their local green space, to make the most of wild places near them. And it's kept them sane. Kept everybody sane. It was heartbreaking when they were talking about closing all the parks and closing all the nature reserves. And I understand why. Of course I understand why. But people were flocking to them for sanctuary and safety, and because they needed them to balance out all the other horribleness that was going on in their lives. And nature was a constant, and it's got louder. That's the great thing. It's actually louder now because we've stopped and we've listened and we're hearing it more now.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're totally right. And where I am in North London, the parks we've got here, you've seen them thrive, really, and from both sense, from a nature, wild nature point of view, and also from people using it point of view, it's thrived in two ways. And I completely agree with everything in regards to mental health. Nature has always been there for me, and it's through someone that's gone through therapy myself, to actually have, you know, one-on-one person therapy, but also I can compare that with just going for a walk in nature, and it has exactly the same effect for me. Like, it can literally, I can talk out something on my mind, or I can go for a walk, sit in a secluded area of a field around nature where I can hear birds, I can feel the grass, and I can get the same level of relaxation after from doing that.
Yeah, that is incredible. You just think there's this resource, it's free, it should be accessible to all. I think there's huge barriers actually with getting people from more disadvantaged backgrounds. I think there's huge problems with how we engage with ethnic communities. I don't think we've really got a handle on that yet.
Yeah.
But the idea of nature being accessible to everybody, especially the most vulnerable in society and the ones who need it the most, is just such a powerful argument now more than ever. And you are entirely right. It is a form of therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And I agree. It's so important that people have access to that as a human right, as much as anything else, of having water and having access to food. It should be a human right to be able to have open space around you to explore.
Yes.
How can social media help us with stuff like this? Because we touched on that when you were talking about the campaign and the youth today with their activism. How can social media work in regards to getting nature accessible for people, or showing people that it's there?
So one of the things that I think social media has done really well, and again, it might just be now in this time of great change and unpredictability, I think what social media has done is it's given people a voice to showcase things in their garden and make more of everyday nature. We're not talking about great exotic landscapes. We're not talking about flying halfway around the world to have a wild experience. I think social media has opened up this world literally right in front of us, where you can go out into your local green space or your garden, take photos of flowers, and have an expert immediately identify them for you. They help you learn about the things in your garden. They help you enhance your experiences. I've seen loads of people sharing footage of hedgehogs and foxes, and I went to a local garden centre last week because I really wanted some pond plants. My pond is just a hole in the ground that my daughter keeps jumping in. Because I've not been able to get any kind of pond plants or anything to adorn my hole in the ground. Because all of the garden centres are sold out of everything. Why are they sold out? Because of massive pushes on social media to promote the importance of wildlife gardening, both for wildlife and for people. And I can't believe it. I went to like two or three garden centres in total, and they all said, oh no, sorry, we're sold out. Everything went in the first 2 days.
Wow.
And I wanted to be annoyed at this because it's still a hole in the ground. It's still very muddy, and she keeps throwing things in it and then herself in it. But at the same time, I'm really happy that other people have had the same idea that I've had.
Yeah.
And other people have dug ponds whilst they've been in lockdown, and they've planted things in their garden. And I think that is massively fueled by social media. I think it makes nature very, very accessible. On the one hand, we've got the big blue chip documentaries like Blue Planet, Blue Planet 2, there was one called Hunted, Planet Earth. They are really important in showcasing star species and star habitats. But on the other side, we must not forget the importance of the wildlife on our doorsteps. And I think that's the role of social media. It's the difference between the blue chip documentary and the footage that anyone can take of a ladybird walking across a leaf and have a bit of positive reinforcement from this powerful wildlife community that says that's amazing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I've one thing I've noticed, and I think I might have said this on an episode already, but the wildlife community, I think, has, from online point of view, for me, has come alive in the last 10 weeks, has really been pushed. A lot more people have been seeing it, have had access to it, and I've seen people creating content much more than they were previous, from a time element, and also because people need it as well.
Yes.
I've noticed that's come around.
Absolutely. I mean, even the way that they've changed the format of BBC Spring Watch now, and it's far more about the stuff that people are actually doing in their own homes, and it's far more about the accessible nature on your doorstep, rather than sending a very expensive film crew off to film something that you're never going to see. that's really difficult, it's suddenly become far more accessible. And you're right, it has all come from social media. It's come from these homegrown films. Mm-hmm. And more people feeling confident to join this community, to ask questions, to make mistakes. That's fine as well. I think we always forget the importance of making mistakes when we're learning.
Yeah.
And there's so many things I can't identify. I am awful at flowers. Can't do flowers. Can't do trees.
I'm going to join you
with
that one.
Trees are horrendous.
Yeah, me too.
It's just a tree. I get really confused. And I think we don't talk about those things enough, and I think there's a tendency to be a bit snobby. So if you don't know about trees, well, you can't put proper natural.
Oh, that's so true. That's so, so true. I feel that all the time when people are like, going, oh, that plant, since that plant. And I'm like, all right, well, just, you know, tell me in a bit more of a, oh, do you like that? I don't know. It always seems that kind of snobby, I know and you don't.
Yes, no, there's a lot of that. But what I love now, actually, is I think the wildlife community's evolved and it's moving away from that.
Yes.
To being really supportive of people making mistakes and to be really supportive of the learning process, where essentially we're just trying to encourage as many people as possible to have a great experience with wildlife. And it can just be a like, it can just be a retweet, it can just be someone answering a really simple question.
Mm.
I just think it has to be open and as educational as possible whilst remaining really, really friendly.
Yeah.
And exciting and not taking out the wonder. If someone misidentifies something, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. It's about the experience they had. It doesn't affect that animal if they were misidentified.
Yes.
That's fine.
Yeah, we don't want to project too much on the animals or the flora or the, or anything there. I don't think they're going to be too over the bothered. But yeah, I completely on side with that one. There was another thing I wanted to ask you about, and it was about the random act of wildness. Can you tell us a bit about what this was and how this came around?
Yes, of course. So I have to confess, I can't take credit for the term. It was my friend Adam who came up with the term random act of wildness. But I was there when he did it. So it's fine. I did ask his permission before I wrote the book and say, is it okay if I casually steal this? And he was very supportive, so it's fine.
Brilliant.
But essentially, the idea of a random act of wildness is any little thing that you can do that connects you with nature on your doorstep. So it can be about enjoying nature, having a kind of sensory experience. It can be about learning something new, learning how to identify something, learning a new skill, learning something about your local area you didn't know before. Or it can be about going that one step further and taking action for wildlife, which I think is the most powerful step on that journey.
Yeah.
And if you imagine that as a journey that someone goes through, where you start off doing the things that make you happy, and then you evolve it to finding out a little bit more, and then you evolve that into genuine action and making a difference in your own life, that becomes a really powerful campaign and a really powerful movement for change. Mm-hmm. Because if you can get half the country, if you can get 30, 35 million people in the country taking action for wildlife in little steps, that becomes something really powerful that government can't ignore, that businesses can't ignore, that landowners can't ignore, that says we care about our natural heritage.
Yeah.
So I'm a massive champion of random acts of wildness because I think put together, they can be one of the most powerful forces for change.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things as well. A lot of people will stand there, and it's no fault of anyone, but you'll stand there and go, well, what can I do? It's just me. It's just one person. What does it matter? But like you said, if 35 million people have that same view, but if you flip it and they do all that one little thing, you've got a huge outcome.
Absolutely. I mean, in lockdown, I've seen about 4 feeding stations go up and down our road with people going out and buying bird feeders, putting them up in the garden, they've started feeding the birds. Now, you know what? It doesn't matter that this isn't really the best time of year to be feeding the birds.
Mm.
It doesn't matter that we've got about 70 jackdaws currently living on welfare on our road. These children do not know how to find food for themselves because they are just eating us all out of fat balls every other day. It's fine because it's about the experience.
Yeah.
And it's about that collective action. And you can see people are getting a bit competitive now with the kind of feeders they put up. So the feeding stations are getting bigger and bigger, and the food sources are getting more and more varied, and the ponds are getting a bit bigger, and the wildflowers, the grass is all getting a bit longer. And that's great. I love it. I love that community sense.
Yeah.
Of taking action for wildlife and being inspired by what your neighbours are doing.
Isn't that great that competition just naturally occurs? Like, usually, if lockdown wasn't a thing, someone would be like, number 32 hasn't mowed their lawn yet. look, they should mow that lawn. But now it's the opposite, going, look, they've got more wildflower than us. Like, it's just not okay. Mm-hmm. That's funny.
We've got one neighbour who's a bit stuffy, who looks very disapprovingly at our lawn, but she got so jealous last year when we had a hummingbird hawk moss in our garden.
I'm jealous of that.
I got so excited, I was screaming.
That's great. I love that natural competition. My last question to you, and this is something I ask everyone that comes onto the show, and I'm always interested in the different bits of advice we get. If you could pass on just one bit of advice to everyone on the planet regarding the natural world, what would you pass on?
I would say going really, really entry level to this, and I would say take notice. Because I think when we take notice consciously, we begin to notice change. And change is incredibly powerful. There's lots of stories now that you hear where people's grandparents say, oh, I don't hear cuckoos anymore, I don't hear nightingales anymore, the turtle doves have disappeared from where I lived. And they know that because they've noticed the change.
Yeah.
We all come under this idea of shifting baseline syndrome, where we don't miss what we didn't know was never there. So I think the most responsible thing that you can start to do is to take notice of what is there, because then when it's not there, you'll miss it. And you'll want to know why, and that will motivate you to take action. I got so scared this year because our house martins were 2 weeks late, and I was genuinely stressed about where our house martins were.
Yeah,
I was getting really upset about it, and the only reason I care about that is because I've noticed them year after year after year, and I wanted to know what had happened to my house martins. Where were they? Now, luckily, they did come back, and they're breeding, and it's so exciting. And right outside our bedroom window, they wake me up at 5 o'clock every morning. double-edged sword.
Yes, of course.
It's just such a powerful thing to take notice, because it inspires that next step. So I want to tell you all to put ponds in, and I want to tell you all to join your local wildlife trust, and I want to tell you all to take part in 30 Days Wild. Obviously, they are all hugely important things. I want to tell you all to buy my book, obviously, 365 Days Wild. Of course I want to tell you all to do that, but I do recognise that the first thing I would say is just take notice of what is on your doorstep and be inspired by it.
Wonderful. Lucy, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about nature and about what it can do for us all. And so thank you very much for being on the show.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I've loved it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks again for tuning in to Into the Wild. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Lucy is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at LucyMcRobert1. Lucy's book, 365 Days Wild, is also available on her website, www.365dayswild.com, or at all major bookstores and online. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, and Podbean, and you can also say hello on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.